Well, today's topic is thinking clearly about what constitutes impact in learning and development. For sure, there are different paths to value. Some L&D has passive value in that it supports recruitment and retention, helps meet regulatory requirements, can inspire career development, and so forth. But for vital learning that's meant to drive business success, L&D leaders have to be very certain and very clear about how they truly add value. Today's guest is Kevin Hannigan, who brings a very straightforward understanding of training impact. Kevin is head of talent consulting at HPC, a behavioral change consultancy based in Dublin, Ireland. He works with Irish and international clients to develop, deliver, and evaluate bespoke solutions that drive performance across their businesses. He's won a number of awards and recognition. He's a former president of the Learning and Development Institute in Ireland. Is a visiting lecturer at University College Cork. Finally, Kevin is a former double world champion in Taekwondo. He brings this passion and discipline for excellence to his work with clients. So welcome, Kevin.
Thanks, Rob. Great to join you today.
Yeah. So Kevin, you suggest a very direct and simple definition of training impact. In a nutshell, what is that?
In many ways, it's pretty simple, Rob. You know, with a few minor exceptions, such as training for regulatory purposes, training for compliance purposes, I put it this way. The amount of impact we get from a training program boils down to this. How much, if at all, have we changed the on-the-job behavior of training participants?
Yeah. So really, it's as simple as that. No behavior change, no impact.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, with the caveat that I suggested earlier, you know, where we need to look at regulatory or compliance purposes. In broad terms, I think when we think about impact, we need to think about changing behaviors, and particular changing the behaviors that matter and measuring this shift or change. And these behaviors are the ones that drive key business metrics. So in our work, we need to be clear about the behaviors we're changing and take steps to measure this.
Right. Well, you mentioned, Kevin, you make the key point here that the behavior, it isn't any old behavior. It's behaviors that have to be consequential, that matter. How do we know what behaviors matter?
If we go back to our old friend, Addy, you know, the start of that is analysis, and that's the foundation of what we do. So we really have to go in and investigate which are the behaviors that matters. One of the things that we observe when we talk to clients and we talk to learning professionals is sometimes they start with training content.
Yeah.
And I would suggest rather than starting with training content, you start with strategy, or you start with the goals that division or that business unit has, and then think about how they're being measured. That's where we start. And then from there, you can start to shift to understanding the behaviors that will enable the strategy. So more often than not, this comes from discussions with senior leaders. Yeah. Sometimes it comes with discussions from other senior stakeholders. But also we look at other sources of data. So we look at engagement surveys, exit interviews, client feedback. There may be lots of other data around, but it gives us an insight into the critical behaviors that matter.
Yeah. Yeah. And importantly, Kevin, I see you making that as sort of a dialogue, a conversation you need to have with those leaders, because I'm sure you've run into instances where they're not so sure about, they haven't thought through those behaviors. As you say, they're starting with the content and haven't really thought through those behaviors. And you make some compelling arguments about why the focus on performance behaviors can make a difference and is very beneficial to driving value from learning investments. Let's talk for a minute about what some of those important benefits are.
Yeah, I think there's quite a few benefits, Rob. And for me, you know, when we talk to learning professionals, they often talk about getting a seat at the table.
Yeah.
And, you know, getting the seat at that table means, I suppose, having data and insight that's of consequence, but it also being able to demonstrate value. And I think this focus on behavior, you know, allows learning professionals to deliver value in a number of ways. And, you know, one of the most straightforward ways is manager engagement.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we think about behaviors and we think about engaging managers, sometimes, you know, we talk about this and we know from research that engagement of managers makes a difference. That really starts to drive behavioral change. But sometimes we don't think about how we might do it. And this focus on behavior, in our experience, helps in three really significant ways. So the first way that we see is it gets buy-in from the managers. Very often managers see it in the diary, or they get a note from the learning team that their colleague or their team member is going off on a training program tomorrow. Please release them and please make sure they get there on time. And they might be told they're doing a program on personal effectiveness, but sometimes they don't really understand what that means. But if we focus in on helping the manager understand that by coming on this program, it's going to help their team member prioritize their time more effectively and minimize dead time or help them make better decisions, then they can immediately see the link between the learning solution or the program and the things that they care about day to day. And these may also be things that they potentially provided feedback to HR, provided feedback as part of a performance review. Yeah. So they can immediately see that link.
Well, I think I really appreciate that you bring that up as really the one of the principal benefits of that. You know, so much of the research we've done has, when we survey managers and find out or inquire into to what extent do they support training, they'll all say, oh, I support it. And they typically, their definition of support is permission to go.
Yeah.
And that's well, what do you, I gave Kevin the time off. What more do you expect me to do here?
Yeah.
So many times they're plagued with these, they're inundated with these requests. And so if they can see that, gee, what's in it for me if Kevin goes, besides having to find somebody to replace him while he's there. So, and that really aligns with research on manager engagement. We know that manager engagement has to go beyond just cheerleading and permission to go. It's got to boil down to specific sorts of coaching, feedback, observing Absolutely. What's happening.
Yeah, and that takes me to really to the other benefits. Is the first is it really allows better conversations between the manager and their colleague about accountability, because it's less about what did you learn, and it's now more about, well, what do I expect you to do, or what does the organization expect you to do as a result of this training? So if I understand the purpose of that, if a manager understands the purpose of that in behavioral terms, they can focus on enabling their team members or their colleagues to do those things more effectively. And they can nudge them to do more, to ask more of themselves, because they understand what it is they've been asked to do, what skills have they been provided with, or have we sought to develop in them?
Yeah.
So we can raise the bar in terms of accountability.
Yeah, and I love that word accountability. You know, again, that aligns so well with research. You mentioned the accountability. If typically, I think people have said, well, my accountability in training is to show up on time, participate in the session, and then when it's over, my accountability is fulfilled. So shifting that focus from, no, you know, if you're my manager, Kevin, I understand you don't expect me to just go to this training. You expect me to actually use it in some very clear ways when I get back, and you're going to hold me accountable for that.
Yeah. And so
it's
a huge difference. And it becomes then much more of a three-way process. So it becomes less of a, I'm a passive recipient of some learning. I mean, you said my job might be to turn up and pay attention. That's barely the tolerance we would have for somebody watching TV. You know, but we're investing thousands in somebody going on a training program.
Yeah.
And really, we've got to have greater expectations. So engaging the manager now allows us to have a three-way relationship between the training department in terms of the skills they're providing and the skills they're seeking to develop, the person attending that training, but the manager. And so that manager now allows, you know, has permission, and I would argue they should be expected to provide very focused coaching. So coming off the program, they can provide coaching at that point of need and really prompting those behaviors, providing feedback, nudging the participant. And so you used the word earlier, cheerleading. It really helps us just move beyond cheerleading and focus on how our team members behave at critical moments.
Well, I love that. And again, coming back to the accountability, you used that word again, that we would hope too that the managers of those managers would be holding those managers accountable for monitoring those behaviors and expecting them. So that's great. You mentioned some other benefits that come from this behavioral definition. Can we move on to what another benefit you see is?
I think it takes us into a really interesting space when we think about design. And I think particularly the shift away from, not the shift away, but the broadening of the conversation beyond content and actually looking at what people do day to day really allows us to focus a little less on what people know and think about more about what they should be doing. So what might that mean? That might mean, well, we actually start thinking about how do we develop better role plays and scenarios that support those new behaviors? How do we build confidence? How do we get people to recognize that a certain behavior is expected at a specific time? So it's not just if we take, say, an example of a manager being able to use a coaching style. It's not that they understand the GROW model. It's that they recognize when somebody comes to them with a problem.
Yeah.
They don't jump in with the solution, that actually they take the time, they sit in their hands and they ask a question instead of providing the answer. So it allows us to start to think about design in a much broader way and start to think about, okay, not just how do I help people develop this new skill, but how do I develop that confidence, that capability, and that situational awareness and judgment to exercise this skill at a particular moment in time.
Wow. So that's really, really shifting the focus of design, not just on the content delivery, but on how people are going to use it in their work. So extends that accountability for the design to be sure that we've included those examples, those checklists, those job aids, the things that will move the needle in the workplace.
All of those things, because we have to think about how do we prompt people to behave in a particular way, or how do we reinforce the need to behave in a specific way? And that's things like checklists, that's things like job aids. But in our work, we also use behavioral nudges, you know, so just these little tweaks, and these little reminders to do certain things at a specific time, always encouraging people to make that shift, not just about what they know, but what they do day to day and how they show up.
In your work, Kevin, as you're working with clients, do you demand this sort of from your designers? You demand that they're not just designing content to push content, but truly behavior support.
Absolutely. I mean, in a world now, Rob, where ChatGPT is everywhere and is part of the conversation on an ongoing basis. Content has become far more democratized than it was when I started in learning development many, many years ago. So the access to information is far easier for people. Mm-hmm. Now it needs to be, how do we shift the needle in terms of what people do? And that's where I suppose our team spend a lot of their time thinking about is it's not so much about what people know, but it is about what they do. And so sometimes that can mean a little less is more. You know, we're not academics, and I have the greatest respect for academics, but that's not what we do, and that's not how we support our clients. We support our clients by shifting behaviors.
Right. Well, Kevin, as you do that, I mean, you know full well, and we know, all of us, that we might know a lot more than we do. I mean, I know full well that I'm not supposed to eat a lot of salt. I know that, but give me a bag of chips and I'll finish them off. So behaviors are driven by more than just knowledge. So if I'm moving into an environment where those behaviors, I have to struggle a bit to do them, how do we, it strikes me that you've expanded now your consultative brief to more than just building people's knowledge, but you've got to consider where they're going to be doing that work, what factors are going to bear on whether they do it well or not, whether they have the time to do it, whether they get the feedback. Is that Is that true that now you have to broaden your engagement with the client to look at that performance context?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a great way of putting it, is just that broadening of perspective. And so we think, and in our language with clients, we talk about the performance context, so the on-the-job behaviors. So that means going beyond just understanding or just having a sense of what people need to know, and actually thinking about, well, what specific behaviors do we want to see, and digging into why mightn't we see those behaviors now? So, you know, yeah, your point earlier about, I might know I shouldn't eat all of these things, but if I open the fridge every day and there's all sorts of things that I shouldn't be eating, then I'm always going to be tempted. And no different in a job. You know, I might know what I want to do, but if we have a certain set of paradigms or beliefs in the organizations, if there's a certain set of incentives pushing certain behaviors, if I see other behaviors rewarded, if there's a lack of supports for specific types of behaviors, they all get in the way of me shifting from that knowing to doing. And so, yes, that becomes part of our dialogue and discussion with our clients, is why mightn't we see this happening right now? What is it right now that might be preventing these behaviors from why mightn't we see these behaviors manifesting? So that takes us into the world sometimes of incentives, that takes us into the world of performance supports, that takes us into sometimes conversations about how people are rewarded and how people are promoted. Yeah. But back to what we spoke about really early on in this conversation, it takes us back to the role of line managers and the kinds of behaviors that they're thinking about and how they're being measured. Because that might be an entirely different set of behaviors that they're trying to get from their team.
Well, that's really a change in mindset for both the learning development side as well as the client side, I guess. I mean, I know that, and we've seen some change as we're moving. Fortunately, one of the benefits of COVID, I think, COVID epidemic meant that we all of a sudden, gosh, we can't go in and do a 3-day workshop with a bunch of people anymore. So we've got to figure out a different way to reach them. But, you know, our brief in the past has always been, well, let's design something really good. And once we give it to them, and it's the end of the day and they've completed their feedback form, it's sayonara.
Yeah.
Goodbye and best wishes and good luck. So we've never been able to get beyond that. I mean, people will say, well, the workshop's over, so you're done. Now it's up to us. There's no more role for the L&D consultant like you to play.
Yeah, and that can be part of the dialogue. And it means that it's, in some ways, it's harder work because it requires us to move beyond our existing paradigms. It requires us to be far more consultative with the business. But it also causes us to expand our perspective on what learning is and where it takes place. Because it's now no longer in the classroom or in the Zoom or Teams environment. Yeah. It's in the performance environment as well. So we have to figure out a way of reaching into that.
Yeah. Well, I know that you use a learning journey approach to your designs. We had talked about that previously. And that also, I know you're using the Promote digital experience platform. How does the use of that technology, does it just make it easier to deliver content, or does it really help you focus more on this behavior, workplace behavior target?
I think for me that it's the latter, Rob. You know, it has the Promote platform, and we've been working with the team in Promote for 7 years now.
Wow.
It's really allowed us to reconceptualize, reimagine what a learning journey could be. You know, previously, and I've worked in this field for over 20 years, the performance environment was largely out of reach of the learning professional. Yeah. You know, as you touched on earlier, you had people in the room, you gave them the content, you gave them what you hoped was a great experience, and you sent them off and you crossed your fingers and hoped you'd had an impact on some people. So the learning designer, facilitator, whoever was responsible, you know, had to understand that performance environment. But really the role was about stimulating curiosity and trying to nudge people along. And you know, the research, and you've been at the forefront of this research, is that's not very effective.
No.
At best, we can hope we'll get a couple of disciples who will take that on and really change their behaviors. But for many people, you know, it won't. We've all seen people coming out of training sessions and they have these, 20 years ago, they had these wonderful folders and, you know, it went onto the shelf behind them, or it went into a drawer, and lo and behold, when they're cleaning out their desk and moving on a couple of years later, they go, well, there's all that good stuff and I haven't done anything with it. So Promote allows us really to reach into the workplace. Yes, it gives us a way of sharing content, and it gives us a way of stimulating social learning, and it allows us to blend learning in many ways that few other platforms, you know, really do. But for me, the most interesting part, and the reason we partner so tightly with Promote, is it allows us to reach into that performance environment. It allows us to see directly what participants are doing. It allows us to get them to try things out, and allows us to get feedback on how they're doing. It allows us to set transfer activities, so where they try to do something and get their manager to give them feedback on it. And so when we're doing that and we're engaging with participants on the platform, that also allows us, as well as monitoring progress, that also allows us to identify blockages. So we're not just relying on simulations anymore. We're really pushing this idea of learning on the job, or as Josh Berzin puts it, learning in the flow of work.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've always, and I know you recall the days of where toward the end of the 3-day workshop, the 2-day workshop, we have everybody complete an action plan.
Yeah.
And then from there on out, we hope.
Yeah.
We hope. But it strikes me now, you actually can, as you say, reach into that environment, give them an assignment to do at work as part of their work, and you'll know whether they did it or not. You'll actually be able to track it.
Exactly.
And nudge it. Yeah.
And nudge it. And it's not that the action plan falls away, but we now have a way of ensuring that people implement that action plan. So back to one of the words we used earlier about accountability. So learning is no longer a 3-day event, but it might be an 8-month journey.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's 3 formal learning days as part of that.
Yeah.
But actually the learning is also happens when they're applying the skills, because that's when we're learning most, I would argue, when we're trying things out.
Kind of cool. There's this behavioral focus, when you combine it with the technology of being able to reach in, it means if you're the training and development guy and I'm the trainee back at work, I got no place to hide now. I can't hide from you, can I? I mean, you're going to find out whether I'm doing it or not, and you're going to be able to help me get feedback on it, and so that implies, I guess, that because you have that power now, that reach power, that we might as take a slightly different approach to our measurement and evaluation work. We're no longer just measuring whether you learned it or not with a test, but can we now approach measurement and evaluation differently as we work with our clients?
Yeah, I think we can, but and I'll talk about that in a second, but I just want to tease out something you said there, because I think it's really interesting, that idea of there's nowhere to hide. And I probably wouldn't say that to our learners directly.
No.
But there is something, we've done some interesting research on this, and actually the fact that we told participants that we were going to measure their behaviors 12 weeks after the end of, when I say the end of a program, after the final workshop, the fact that we told them, because we asked them, did that encourage you to implement these behaviors? You know, were you more focused on implementing the behaviors? And 80% of people said yes.
Wow.
So it's really quite interesting that just that simple act of saying, this is the reason you're on the program, these are the behaviors we want you to change, we're going to support you as part of this journey, there's going to be some formal learning, and then there's going to be some learning and practice on the job, and your line manager is going to be connected through the Promote learning platform, and we're going to check in to see the extent to which that's changed. that in and of itself encourages participants to shift their behaviors. So I thought when we did that, when we got that data back, I was quite fascinated by it. Just that the very act of saying we're going to measure actually stimulated some of that change.
Well, it's posing a whole, like we kept talking about the term accountability. It's posing a different context for that accountability, is it now? Because now we're sort of all on the same team here, the manager, the L&D people, and the trainees. It's a behavior focus, and we know now that the goal is different. The goal is all about behavior.
And that shared understanding, because the original question you asked me was about, you know, its impact on evaluation. I think it's that shared understanding that's really critical, because it's those behaviors that are the critical link between the hard metrics that the business might want to see. So whether that's sales or whether that's attrition or whatever it might be, the behaviors are the link between that data and the learning program. And they're the ones that can make or break the success of the program.
Yeah.
Because if we don't see those behaviors shifting, we're not really going to see the metrics shifting. And I'd probably argue as well, if we can't show those metrics shifting, or if we can't show those behaviors shifting, I should say, even if we see the metrics shifting, who's going to believe us? You know, the metrics shifted, but was that you really? Because nothing else changed.
Yeah.
But if we can show there was a learning journey and here's the evidence that behaviors have started to shift, then if the metrics start to shift, we can begin to make that causal link between the learning journey and the metrics.
Right. And again, that, you know, when we talk in terms of accountability, it's also changing. It's certainly changing if you're approaching measurement in that way. It's changing the client's expectation of what you're going to do for them as well, isn't it? So, I mean, you're not just contracted to deliver the training and out of here. You're actually now more of a, I guess, a business partner with them. You're sitting at the table with them as well, aren't you? Helping move the needle.
Absolutely. And you know, if we go back to some of the earlier conversation about starting with strategy.
Yeah.
You know, you're there to help the client enable the strategy. Mm-hmm. So now it is about partnership. It's not just you're a cost center delivering training. You're actually there with them, moving the needle when it comes to them being able to execute the strategy.
Well, I really like what you said about you're sort of surfacing the critical path. I mean, on the one hand, I've got the training that we're doing. On the other hand, I've got some metrics they care about in the business, whether it's greater retention, greater employee engagement, more sales, less waste, whatever, more greater productivity. I think there was a pretty big black box in between the training and those metrics. So you're kind of shining a light in there and say, look, these behaviors are the critical path. Mm-hmm. They're what it's going to take to get there. I mean, that what I know from the evaluation side is that if we deliver the training and it's supposed to change retention rates, and then we wait a year and then measure the retention rates and find out, if we found out at that point that nobody ever used the training in the first place, we've lost that year to intervene and shape the behavior.
Absolutely.
So what you're talking about, measuring these behavior change, we can start that within weeks after the training, not a year. And if it's not changing now, because you've also looked at the performance context, as you say, you can say, well, it's not changing because this, this, or this. And if we change those things, we're going to get back on the critical path.
And I think that's a really important point, Rob, because, you know, waiting a year for some of that data to come through, or sometimes even longer, if you're waiting for another engagement survey to roll around, it can take, you know, any length of time, up to 2 years. But actually, with that focus on behavior and actually understanding the extent to which they are shifting, or the extent to which they're shifting in one team but not shifting in another, allows us to really delve in and understand what's going on that's maybe not giving us, you know, where we're not seeing the impact that we want to see. And it allows us to do that critical work really early, rather than, as you say, wait passively for a year and hope that it has shifted. And so much can change in that year.
Now, how do clients, when you focus on those behaviors and you feedback, you say, well, okay, we're getting this behavior to change, we're getting this behavior to change. Is that being accepted as evidence that the things are working, or are clients say, well, behavior, I want to see some hard data here? What's your take on that?
I think one of the interesting things we've noticed as we've shifted to this focus is if we have co-created the behaviors with senior leaders. So if they have made that link between the metrics, the data, their strategy, and the behaviors that they believe are going to deliver that, if you can show that those behaviors are changing because of that process of co-creation, they're much more likely to accept that the metrics will move. And it's not every leader will be completely accepting of it, but I think if they can see the input that they've had and they feel like they've participated in that process, then it's a much easier conversation to have, Rob. And that sometimes is enough. Or it certainly starts a dialogue about, okay, now we have a lot more confidence. And sometimes out of that confidence then comes a desire, actually, let's move the needle a little bit further. Can we push that behavior a little bit more? Can we see more of that? Can we make sure the results are consistent in every team across the organization? So that creates a desire for success, which in turn supports the overall process.
Sure, and I'm sure it keeps them supporting the effort. It isn't that because your engagement isn't done when you deliver the training, you're still working together to keep that going. And they know, what I hear you saying is, they know that the behaviors were the keystone. They were the thing that had to change. But they know also that there was a reason why they were going to change those, because they wanted these other things to occur. So they're well bought into it. You know, Kevin, it certainly strikes me from you mentioned earlier that L&D leaders have complained for decades about not getting a seat at the table. It really strikes me that you've given us some very good sage advice, and not just advice, but specific things we can be doing to earn that seat at the table. And we do need to earn it, don't we?
Yeah, no, we absolutely do. And I think getting that seat at the table, not to labor the point, requires us to think a little bit differently.
Sure does. Well, Kevin, been great talking with you. Is there anything else you want to say before we go here? This has been really helpful.
No, just to say thank you, and I've really enjoyed the conversation.
I have as well, and I hope all our listeners have. Thanks so much.
Great. Thank you, Rob.